CliffCentral.com.
I'm always fascinated by the latest developments in biotechnology, and of course these things are becoming more and more obviously important to us as they're starting to unlock some of the secrets of not only the human genome and which genes do what and what you can switch on and what you can switch off. And there's this editing software called CRISPR, which is amazing because that allows us to essentially mark certain parts of the DNA and either cut out and insert other stuff or move things around. It's an incredible and very, very technical science, an area of enormous research and development at the moment, a place that all the big tech companies are interested in being involved in. Google and Apple and maybe not Apple yet, but certainly Google are interested in this. I know that there are people like Jennifer Doudna, who was the one of the team who discovered this CRISPR technology, who has been at the forefront, really, of trying to figure out ways for us to understand more about what this code, this DNA structure in our cells, is in control of and in command of, and what it does and what it produces, and how it can perhaps make us live longer, live healthier. So someone who knows a whole lot more about this than I will know is Dr. Daniel Myersfield, and he is a molecular biologist. It's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you for coming in to see us.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
First of all, when Deep Fried Man saw you sitting out there, he said, "Is that really a doctor? He looks like a soap star doctor." You know, like those soap opera doctors who are always tremendously good looking and seem to have this TV role, but they can't possibly be brilliant as well.
But coming from Deep Fried Man, you can't really take it too seriously.
No, don't. This is an interesting field. What got you interested in molecular biology?
Well, it was quite a fortuitous journey, I suppose, that took me to where I am now. I always wanted to do medicine. And I didn't get into medicine after school, so I did the BSc route, majoring in genetics. And when I did my honors in genetics and I got into the lab and I was doing research, I just absolutely got bitten by this research bug. I really loved being in the lab. I loved doing the research. I loved the exploration. I got fascinated by this world of DNA that you were describing. And so I stuck with it and ended up with a master's and did a PhD. Excuse me. And then you sort of turn around, you've got a PhD in molecular biology, and you think, well, now what? You know, what do you sort of do with that?
But what a time to be alive in terms of studying this stuff, because it was very, up till a short while ago, when computers really allowed us to do the kind of analysis that we can do overnight. It used to take tens of, maybe, hundreds of days to figure out what was going on, to sequence things, to figure that stuff out. Now, thanks to computers, to machine learning, to the ability for us to do via various nanotechnological means an analysis, it makes this world of yours that you've understood from before this revolution and have seen go through it and now are on the other side of, makes things possible that were just impossible before.
It is a fascinating world. The first human genome took 15 years to sequence.
There we go.
There was a massive collaborative
Crick and Watson.
Effort. Crick and Watson
started that, right?
Watson and Crick discovered the helix.
The DNA.
They identified the structure. And Rosalind Franklin, who was in the lab, and as the female, got no credit for it. But she was integral to that as well. but it was Craig Venter who drove the Human Genome Project. And it was a massive collaborative effort. He was the one who eventually announced the sequence and published the first draft back in 2003. That took 15 years. Now you can sequence a full genome within a couple of days.
So why would you want to do this? Let's imagine I'm just an ordinary person. I've got, I don't know, 10 grand lying around and I want to have my genome sequenced. What advantage does that give me? What does it do for me?
Well, what you're going to end up with is a huge amount of information. Uh-huh. What you do with that information, it becomes the key. So what I do in my business, we don't do genome sequencing. Mm-hmm. We look at specific regions of your DNA, very specific regions, differences in your DNA compared to my DNA that have been associated with particular outcomes. So if you take, your previous interview, you guys were joking about gluten. That is an example. Some people are sensitive to gluten. Some people are at risk for celiac disease. Mm-hmm. Other people can eat gluten and not have any problems with it. So a genetic test can tell you that.
But I'm curious, and I know this isn't the area that you're involved in necessarily, but what does Craig Venter do when it comes to sequencing this stuff? And I know that we've got each chromosome carries different traits and important factors when it comes to our physical, our mental, even perhaps our emotional. We don't know about that yet, but makeup. This is the nature part of us, as opposed to the nurture part of us. These are things that have been formed and polished and changed over millennia of evolution, you know, years and years and years of humans adapting to survive. So some of this stuff is quite well understood. There are obviously parts of the various chromosomes that people have a pretty good idea do a certain thing, and they can fiddle around with those with a degree of success. Let's say, for example, we get to a point where we can eliminate certain diseases if you manage to get early warning signs and change the makeup of those particular parts of the DNA in an embryo, for example. I mean, this is potentially what's possible. But there's a little bit of science fiction going on there too, right?
Well, there is. I mean, where it is at the moment is, you know, we've got this genomic information. We've got the blueprint that is the DNA. Mm-hmm. What's come out of there is they've managed to pinpoint many of the disease-causing genes. So you can now do genetic tests to ascertain whether a disease is likely to manifest. Mm-hmm. In some cases, that association between the disease and the gene is fairly cast in stone almost. If you have the gene mutation, there is a very strong likelihood that you're going to get the disease.
Yeah,
that's what we call high penetrance. In other cases, and this is what we're learning more and more, is that the gene expression is modifiable. So it's not cast in stone, and it's not predetermined. It's not entirely your destiny.
And it's not an on or off either.
It's not an on or off.
You can almost turn the knob a little
Correct.
Bit and decide you want this Correct. At 70% or at 30%.
Well, to a certain extent, yeah. I mean, there's a very strong interplay between the genes we have in the environment in which we place ourselves. So the expression we use is genes load the gun, but lifestyle pulls the trigger. So when it comes to health, for example, much of our health is really in our own hands. We can't sit back and blame our genes for the vast majority of chronic diseases. Cardiovascular disease, diabetes, these things, you know, they're so lifestyle related. We might have a genetic predisposition, and some people based in their genes might have an increased risk as compared to others. But ultimately, it's in our hands how we manage that risk. And that's where understanding what's going on at a biochemical level can help either patients or doctors to intervene specifically to ameliorate those risks.
So explain to me and perhaps to people who know as little as I do, how actually the DNA works. What is the process? The DNA consists of this code, and it combines with proteins in the cell who then replicate that code in certain stretches. There are amino acids involved in that.
Okay, so we're going genetics 101 in 10
minutes. Help me to, because I want to be clever after this, at least a little bit better than I am now.
Okay, so at a very sort of high level, what is happening is your DNA consists of four chemical bases, four nucleotides, exactly, G, A, T, and C, as they're commonly called. And those four letters spell out the code that is the DNA. In the same way as the English alphabet has 26 letters, those letters can be grouped together to make words. The words are grouped together to make sentences. So at the DNA level, your nucleotides are grouped together in groups of three to make amino acids, and those amino acids join together to form proteins. These proteins then perform all of the functions necessary within a cell. So if you take a spelling change in a word, you change it, take a cat and change the C to an H, you end up with hat. Change the word, it changes the meaning of a sentence. Suddenly you're wearing a cat on your head. Exactly the same thing happens at the level of DNA. If you change one of the letters within that code, it changes the amino acid, it changes the protein that gets produced, and it can change the way in which that protein functions.
And that's how the cell lives and works.
And okay. So what we do is we look at the code between the different individuals, and based on the findings that are published, the studies that have been done, there are very specific areas of DNA that are known to be associated with particular outcomes. So we can look at your DNA, and we can tell you based on that how the genes that metabolize fats work, your risk for certain chronic diseases. But we focus very much on the ones that are modifiable. So we're looking on, we can't change the genes, but we can change the expression of the genes.
You have to know where to look.
Yeah.
And that can be very complicated because you're dealing with I mean, in a chromosome, you have how many of those base pairs? Millions.
3 billion.
3 billion.
Nucleotides.
In one of the medium-sized chromosomes? Or are you talking about in the whole nucleus? That's an unbelievable amount of information. I mean, that's probably more than most computers can store in terms of binary code.
It's a massive amount of data, but that's where the technology has advanced to such an extent that when we take that DNA into the lab, so we do our test by means of a cheek swab. That swab comes into the lab. We purify the DNA off the swab.
Mm-hmm.
We're left with the whole genomic DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And then through a process called PCR, which is a very established technique, it's been around for quite a few years now, we can hone in on specific regions of the DNA, and we do what we call a cluster analysis. So the one nucleotide would link to a specific dye, the other nucleotide to another dye, and based on where the fluorescence pattern appears, you know which nucleotide is present within that particular person.
So then you can draw up on paper what that code looks like, and you can make alterations to it.
So you're not making alterations to the code, but you can manage the effect of what you're seeing.
Okay.
So you can never change the DNA.
So let's say, for example, that I have a predisposition to something like, I don't know, a heart condition, a heart disease condition. This will warn me in advance. It could tell me in my 20s or 30s that I might have this problem in my 50s or 60s. So I can guard against that and make sure that I have the healthiest heart possible.
Exactly.
So I don't end up with the repercussions of that genetic predisposition later on.
Exactly. So we find, you know, the way we kind of talk about it is that the information we give you is very much empowering. We are telling you where your risk factors lie, and we are giving you the tools to try and overcome or lessen those risks.
Are you able to, I mean, how much information can you give me when it comes to doing these? Let's say I do the cheek swab with you. Are you going to say to me, oh, holy shit, you've got cancer on the way. Sorry.
No. There's
you're not going to be able to do
not.
That.
Definitely not. we kind of have tests that span pretty much a full spectrum of health, from helping you the way you train for a race, an endurance event, or a power event. We can look at your power potential, genes associated with power endurance, with soft tissue injury risk, with recovery.
Mm-hmm.
We can look at your propensity for weight management, how important is exercise for weight. So, you know, this idea of one-size-fits-all diet, everybody needs to be banting, or everybody needs to be on the South Beach diet, or whatever it might be. You know, we've moved past that, and we work through healthcare practitioners. We've got dietitians all over the country who, when a patient comes in to their rooms, the first thing they will do is a DNA test, just to give them that extra insight into that individual to understand how best to manage them going forward.
Are there some absolute dead cert markers that you can, within moments of doing the analysis, be able to ascertain, all right, this person absolutely has a condition, or they've inherited a condition around this organ, or there's, you know, this potential problem?
So some of the genes are what we call more high penetrance, which means they're more strongly linked to that problem or that eventual disease. The one is the APOE gene, which is quite strongly linked to Alzheimer's, risk for Alzheimer's. It doesn't mean you have it. It means that there's a marginally increased risk as compared to other members of the people in the population. But again, there are certain things that you can do about it. You know, your intake of omegas and lipids becomes very, very important. So we're still trying to put the information across in a way that is empowering and that you can manage yourself.
So you run this private business. Were you very frustrated when you started out that there wasn't enough research being done in this area?
In retrospect, I started a bit early in South Africa, certainly. It was very early days.
Did people think you were mad?
Very much so.
What are you doing here?
Some people still do.
Why are you trying to make yourself unhappy? The pace of ordinary research in the country is down here. Why are you trying to go up there?
So I think one of the things that frustrated me when I finished my PhD and came out of that research environment was this massive knowledge gap that exists between the incredible information that sits within the academic environment, that sits in the peer-reviewed journals that the academics are aware of, and the consumer actually getting some benefit from that research. And one of my goals was to narrow that gap. You know, if you could have two Santon housewives talking about which version of the coffee gene they have and why they can't metabolize caffeine, you know, that information is available. And it's really, it's massive. It comes out of a massively complex area and an amazing research that went into it. But it can also be very practical and very useful to the average person. And that's what we wanted to achieve, is to bring this this technical information, this complex information, and make it relevant.
I think that sounds fascinating. You still like spending time in the lab?
No.
you haven't been in the lab for a while?
I haven't been in the lab for a while.
I mean, when you were doing it, though, it must have been pretty interesting stuff, because I would imagine you still have to keep abreast of a lot of the latest findings and you know, the work that's being done now. Obviously, the benefit, too, of living in 2018 is that if someone discovers something in California or in India, they're able to share it almost instantly. Good. And it gets a peer review, and other people can implement the tests on their side to see that there's some veracity to them. There must have been some fascinating things discovered in the last 3-5 years that have blown even your mind.
I think one of the most exciting areas for me is the area of pharmacogenomics, which is the link between how we metabolize, or between our genes and how we metabolize prescription medications. If you look at the number of people on, you know, antidepressants or cardiovascular medications, taking them chronically, a massive proportion of people are taking drugs that are simply not working or actually making them more sick through side effects and what we call adverse drug reactions. And what we can now do is we can do a genetic test up front. We can tell the doctor which drug is going to be most effective, which drug is going to cause a side effect, and get them onto the right drug in the shortest time possible. So for me, that's one of the most exciting areas of this field, because it's just so immensely relevant that you could have a test like that almost at birth. The information can sit in an electronic health record. And any time in the rest of your life, a doctor wants to prescribe a medication, you simply check an app, for example, and say, no, I can't take that drug. You know, I need
and you can cross-reference what your genetic preferences might be. And obviously for things like weight loss, this could have enormous potential.
Yeah, you know, it's and the genes aren't everything, so we always ensure that we want to be putting it into the right context. A dietitian sitting with a patient will know not a lot more about them than just their genetics. They'll know their lifestyle, their food preferences, any intolerances, allergies, etc. But the genetics is a key part of it. And the genetics is what really differentiates one person from another and gives them that insight into their patient that the others wouldn't have.
Can you believe this incredible CRISPR technology that they've played with in the last little while? I mean, it's only really in its infancy in terms of being put to use, but they say that in places like China, people are already experimenting on, you know, embryonic animals, for example, and changing everything from eye color to the number of toes.
Well, it's a little bit scary. I mean,
it is, right?
We're not quite sure where it's going to go, and we might be a little bit worried if we knew what is really going on in some research labs. I'm not sure that everything that's happening is being spoken about.
And quite possibly on humans as well. I mean,
yeah,
I'm certain that there are parts of the world where they don't care about human rights.
I think there's a big kind of argument to be made about the ethical responsibility that comes with these types of technologies. And so it's a big black box, really, in terms of what is the potential, what can be done, and where do you draw the line in terms of what you want to do and how do you use this information.
If you were able to do just about anything, would you feel ethically bound to have to conform to some code? Would you feel that there needed to be some authority, whether it was a government or a health practitioner's council or something, that oversaw this kind of thing? Because clearly, you know, you can't have a Dr. Moreau's island one day. And similarly, you don't want to starve progress by putting an end to research that is considered unethical by perhaps religious fundamentalists or other groups. There is a happy medium, hopefully.
There is a happy medium. How one finds that or how one gets everyone to agree on what that happy medium is, I'm not quite sure. But, you know, I think there's a big jump from what happens in research labs, and maybe some of it I personally wouldn't feel as ethical. Other people might feel it is. So again, there's that happy medium. But a far jump from there to what gets incorporated into mainstream medical practice and what becomes routine. I think it's going to require some sort of governance at some level. Ideally, you'd want it, I suppose, to be self-regulated, that people's own levels of morality would dictate what they should or shouldn't be doing. But maybe that's a little bit naive.
You know what's amazing? I was looking at a list the other day of they've come up with a list to rank all the animals by chromosome count, right? And there's an ant, a jack jumper ant, which has 2 or sometimes even 1 chromosome. And then you have a daisy that has 12. And a daisy obviously isn't an animal, it's a plant, but it has 12 chromosomes, and the ant, in this case, this particular ant, has one, sometimes two chromosomes. It's just unbelievable. You go all the way down the list, and you get animals like an Atlas blue, which is a butterfly, that has 448 to 452 chromosomes. And that is absolutely incredible.
That is amazing.
We have 34. What is it? 32. How many do we have?
Humans? Well, we've got... how many do we have? We've got...
I think it's 32 or 33. No. Anyway, we've got... It doesn't seem like a lot when you compare it to all these other animals. I mean, there are probably things that are a lot more complicated than us that have less.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a lot. And what we also don't have that many of is genes. I think when they were busy with the genome project, they expected that we'd have far more genes than just the sort of 20-odd thousand that we ended up having. So the complexity comes not in the number of genes, but in the manner in which the genes are regulated and controlled.
Some of the genes are quite long. Mm. They contain quite a lot of these these base pairs. Okay. And some of them are very short. Now, you mentioned amino acids are three, right? So I'm fascinated about how you know you've reached the end of a gene and how you might cut it off one base pair too soon and you lose important information.
Well, interestingly, it's one of the tests that we do.
Oh, really?
There's a gene, I don't think which one it is now, it's the actin gene, which codes for your muscle fibers.
Yeah.
And those groups of three nucleotides are called a codon. And there's a particular combination of three nucleotides that gives you what you call a stop codon. And that stop codon is an instruction for the protein that's manufacturing, that's putting together amino acids to put in the last one, and that's now the end of the protein. And what you can get is a base change that's accidentally forms the stop codon instead of an amino acid, and so you get a truncated protein.
Now we're getting into the science. This is really getting complicated. By the way, I just had to check because I wasn't even sure, but we have 23 pairs, and that's a total of 46. Correct. But a pistachio nut's got as many as that, Sia. So you're about as complicated genetically as a pistachio nut. How does that make you feel?
Well, I have been called a nutcase in many an instance, so I resonate.
We know that we've got these little things in our cells called mitochondria, and they have their own DNA. Obviously, that doesn't affect the way that the cell works like the nuclear DNA does, because those things are almost self-contained little creatures.
Those are the sort of the so-called energy units,
right,
of the cell.
All they do is produce energy, and we don't know whether once in our history we found some way of symbiosis with these little mitochondria, and they decided they could live in our cells and produce energy for us, whether they're slave cells or whether, you know, there's a kind of a mutual
symbiotic relationship.
A situation where they get something from us and we get something from them. And are we even them? I mean, what part of us defines us when you get to the cellular level? Is it the cell? Is it the DNA? Is it the mitochondria in our DNA? Because you inherit those obviously from your mother, because the cell, all the sperm contributes is a little bit of chromosome.
Yeah, exactly. A bit of the Y.
A bit of the Y and then, you know, the other half of each base pair for the nucleus. But there's so much interesting stuff that we can do now also, because we can see so much more. We can analyze it at a tiny, tiny microscopic level. Stuff that before, even the most powerful microscopes, you couldn't really get that close, right? Mm.
Well, I mean, you sort of hit the nail on the head at the beginning where you said what an exciting time it is to be in the space. You know, there's just so much development happening on the technology side that enables the research on the biology side. We're constantly learning new things and seeing new findings and how we then apply those within the healthcare environment is obviously up to us as the researchers and the companies to say, right, we now have enough evidence for this particular gene, let's use it.
Are there diseases that we know are almost completely genetic?
Yeah, definitely.
And are there things we can do about that?
Not always. So, I mean, you know, for example, and I think the term genetic testing has changed quite a bit over the last few years. There's so many more applications now for a genetic test. But historically, a genetic test was two parents considering having a child would have a genetic test to determine whether the kid might have a disease. And it's still quite prevalent within the Jewish community. You screen for Tay-Sachs
disease. Yeah.
Exactly. And there are others where there's a very, very strong genetic component. And in that case, it is, you know, there's not necessarily something that you can do about it.
But you can be pre-warned.
Yes.
If you do these tests.
Correct.
So I suppose a lot of people also want that. They want to come to you almost as a preemptive measure and have these tests done so that you can have a look and say, well, you know what, there might be this, there might be that. And of course, it's not foolproof yet because, like anything in nature, it's open to some degree of interpretation.
Absolutely.
Figure out everything. You're not going to have 100% answer for it.
It's very much looking at potential risk factors and increased risk and, you know, managing that risk accordingly.
What for you are the most exciting areas of development at the moment when it comes to genes and genetic technology? And
I think what's happening within the, we haven't spoken about it all, but within the cancer space, the the ability to do a biopsy from a drop of blood, not having to actually get a sample of the tumor, you can now take a drop of blood and look at the gene expression of that tumor because the markers are circulating within the peripheral circulation.
Wow.
So that type of technology for me is amazing. To be able to do a non-invasive biopsy is would be life-changing in many cases.
How long does it take you to do this analysis?
Our tests take around 2 weeks.
Wow, is that it?
Yeah.
2 weeks?
2 weeks for the report, and you know, if we have to, it could be done in 2 days.
Have you ever had someone give you a swab and you couldn't get anything out of it?
We've had people send in a swab from their dog to try and test us.
And you've obviously picked up that.
Not that it's dog, quick, but that it's, there's something wrong. It failed.
No. You're like, whoa, hang on a second. This is a very disease. This person has rabies.
I'm giving people a whole bunch of ideas here that I don't necessarily want to.
And you were able to find in a study that you called the human sweet tooth, you were able to determine that you can blame your genes if you have a sweet tooth.
Yeah, so I mean, it's again, you know, these studies that are published where it's so much to do with eating behavior is related to our genes. So we know there's a gene that governs sweet tooth. It's things like snacking behavior, feelings of satiety, the way you perceive sugary substances. You know, all of these things are governed at a genetic level.
Wow.
And so having knowledge of them, knowing that you have a propensity to snack or to binge eat or whatever it might be, it just gives you that power to manage that behavior a little bit better.
And personalized nutrition, this is obviously also something that you can advise on. So you look at what people are, you know, in terms of their genes, likely to need.
Correct. So again, we're looking at sort of the health risks at a cellular level and telling people, you know, if you're going to take nutritional supplements, take something that your body actually needs rather than just, you know, what the guy at the pharmacy tells you. Be specific. You know, it could be targeted supplementation to work on specific biochemical pathways within your body that we can tell are not functioning optimally.
How long do you think it'll be before insurance companies start developing different premiums for people based on their genes?
I think it's a way off, but I think it's probably coming.
And then they would have different risk profiles because maybe you've got, you know, this and that condition embedded in your DNA.
Correct. But you've got a question, is that wrong?
Yeah, well, it's another question
it's
about
a whole
ethics,
other question,
isn't it?
Exactly.
It's a complicated world you work in.
Very.
Well, thank you. Dr. Daniel Meyersfeldt. He's the molecular biologist. And what's your company called so we can
D-Analysis.
D-N-A-L-Y-S-I-S.
Yeah.
Right.
That's it.
You can find out more by looking them up on the internet. And this is terrific. I'm so appreciative. I really am fascinated by this stuff, as you could probably tell. I think loads of us are because it's who we are.
Yeah. No, it's a fascinating space to be in. Thanks so much for having me.
What an interesting business you're in. Sure. Don't think you have boring days at work.
No, I don't.
Amazing. Amazing. Thank you so much for talking
to us. Thank you. CliffCentral.com.